All right. Welcome, everybody. Today is May 11, 2017. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And today we have an informational meeting from Oregon Housing and Community Services on the budget overview. So thank you, Director Margaret Salazar.
The chair is going to be really nasty and picky about all this, too, today. So it's really got to be perfect.
We're going to make sure all those Excel sheets line up and add up. Formulas are all right.
We aim to please. All right. Good morning, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come back and address the committee this morning. What we are prepared to do today is to present to you an overview of our agency programs. This is a follow-on to the Agency 101 presentation that we provided at the very start of the session, and we're also using some of the material that we prepared for our Ways and Means Budget Subcommittee and presented earlier this spring. So we'll start off today by giving you a little bit of a reminder about our agency's mission and vision. Our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and to live free from poverty. And our mission is to provide stable and affordable housing and engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for Oregonians. And really the way we see housing is part of a foundation and a platform to allow Oregonians to pursue opportunities, health outcomes, safety outcomes, education outcomes, and economic outcomes. So we see housing as the foundation to allow families and individuals to pursue all of those other critical needs. And again, we wanted to remind the committee a little bit about our agency, where we've been and where we're headed. As a historical perspective, in the 2011 to 2013 biennium, our agency faced fiscal and programmatic uncertainty. And in 2011, a director was brought on to address the financial challenges at OHCS and to determine if the agency should be dismantled. So there were some big questions facing the agency at that time. The agency was then restructured and reorganized, and a number of changes took place, leading to all new executive management and 12 positions, including six management positions, being eliminated. OHCS went through a scenario build process to determine the best possible structure for the agency and delivery systems for the many programs that come through OHCS. So there were significant changes underway during that time period, and at least two reorganizations occurred during a short amount of time. A transition effort began with the goal to focus agency programs to be mission-oriented and to create more efficient delivery systems. So in the 2013 to 2015 biennium, a number of those changes began to be implemented. OHCS recommended that the agency stay intact and acknowledged that there were concerns about the financial sustainability of the agency and its operations. The agency had the second year of our funding withheld pending a report to the legislature on alternate service delivery models for 2015 and beyond. And the legislative report in 2014 focused on improved service delivery, effectiveness, and fiscal sustainability. The legislature ultimately approved that report and approved the second year of funding. And in July of 2014, OHCS published a new strategic framework focused on inward-facing strategic imperatives and what we like to refer to now as sort of getting our house in order and rebuilding the foundation of the department so that we could meet our mission. There was a considerable amount of work done at that time. So in this past biennium, 2015 to 2017, our agency accomplished a balanced budget through key activities including staffing reductions, streamlined operations. There were food programs and other ancillary programs that are critical but don't quite serve our agency's mission that were moved to other agencies and homes. And we received general fund support to offset the subsidy required to keep the Oregon Volunteers Program up and running as well. And in that time, of course, we were also fortunate enough to receive funding for some new critical programs, including the LIFT program, local innovation, and fast-track housing, which we'll be speaking about later today, as well as a new mental health housing program that we've stood up in the last couple of years. So this is all just to give you some history about our agency and the tremendous change and evolution over the past few years that sets the stage for where we are today and where we're headed into the future. So as I think the committee members are aware, I came on as the new director in November of 2016, right at the time that we received Secretary of State performance audit that our agency had participated in for the prior year. And there were some major themes of the audit that we've taken to heart, and as you'll hear about today, we are working hard to address. One of the major themes of the audit was affordable housing preservation, and the auditors really found that our agency does not have a strategic program to address the need to preserve aging affordable housing and to really identify the risks in our portfolio, to understand the coming needs for aging properties, and to be able to have a comprehensive approach to address those challenges. But while the auditors looked at affordable housing preservation, they really used that as a jumping off point to look at the agency's overall operations, and they provided some very healthy constructive criticism that we've taken to heart. So one of the key findings of the audit was that we do not have sufficient strategic planning. The auditors really found that in two regards. One, our agency has not completed a statutorily required statewide housing plan in quite some time. In fact, we are not able to locate the last version of the statewide housing plan. It's a statutorily mandated plan that requires our agency to understand the existing housing market, the needs of Oregonians, and to understand the needs of different communities and demographic groups. We concur that that is a critical need for our agency, and the good news is that the agency had already started on the path of doing the data work to complete a statewide housing plan before the audit was published. We are now moving down the track on the statewide housing plan. We have engaged a consulting group to help us do robust outreach, to reach communities, to get their feedback for the statewide housing plan. And by this time next year, we expect to have a completed plan that will not only document the need for housing, but also dovetail into a five-year strategic plan for our agency. So that work is well underway. The auditors also found that we need to do a better job of data management. So everything from just how we manage our existing day-to-day work in our affordable housing, rental housing programs, to how we use that data to then create reports and be able to inform our policy decision making, the auditors found that we need to do a much better job. That includes a wholesale improvement to our data system and procurement of a new contemporary modern data system that will allow us to do things like accept electronic applications for our funding, which right now we do by hand. So really modernizing our data work, but also being able to integrate the front end of our affordable housing development with the back end of monitoring our portfolio, which we think is appropriate oversight and governance of our affordable housing resources. And then finally, and I think one thing that we've really taken on is the need to do a better job of communication and just organizational management. As I mentioned, there was tremendous change over the last few years, and you know that creates an environment that's challenging for employees to really kind of move out of and understand their new expectations, their new positions, new leadership. So we have a lot of work to do internally to make sure that we are focusing on employee engagement and really involving staff and helping to set the direction forward for the agency. Also engaging better with our Housing Stability Council, which is now our advisory body that really oversees all of our work, to make sure that we appropriately fill the vacancies on that Housing Stability Council and move them toward their role of being the policymakers at Oregon Housing and Community Services beyond their traditional role, which was really focusing on approving affordable housing transactions. So we have a lot of internal management work to do as well. So as in an effort to address some of those immediate needs, we engaged our staff at all levels to create strategic goals for 2017. You all have a hard copy of this. This is up on our website, and we have shared this with some key partners that we work with. We're very, very excited and proud of this effort. We engaged staff at all levels to really identify the key mission focus for the year, the programs that they are working on, the immediate needs that we have to really communicate to our partners how we are going to move our mission forward to meet the needs of Oregonians. So we have created 7 strategic goals for the year. The first 2 goals focus on building a stronger OHCS. Goal 1 has to do with building a stronger OHCS that addresses some of those internal management needs that I spoke about and also focuses on our financial health. Goal 2 is to build a stronger OHCS that engages and serves our communities. And that has to do, of course, with completing that statewide housing plan effort, as well as creating new tools to more effectively communicate and receive feedback from our partners around the state. Goal 3 is to work to address the rental housing gap. As we know, we have too many Oregonians, more and more, in fact, in the last few years that just see housing as out of reach, have a very high housing cost burden, are paying too much for housing, or are at risk of falling into homelessness. So we have some exciting work going on this year to shore up our funding streams, to target our funding to very low-income families, and to, as I mentioned before, modernize our data and delivery system so that we're more efficiently providing our resources in the rental housing arena. Goal 4 is around addressing homelessness, preventing and reducing homelessness. As you'll hear about today, we have ongoing work that we do through community action agency partners to prevent and address homelessness. But what we're setting out to do this year is to take that work a step further, which is to say, how can we provide new leadership at the state level to engage our local partners across the state in the work that they're doing on homelessness? And the two of the areas that we're focusing on are to address veteran homelessness. We were very proud and excited to work with the governor recently as she made an announcement that we are going to be partnering with our friends at Veterans Affairs to end veteran homelessness. That's some work that's been ongoing. It's an initiative that has really taken off at the federal level. We've had great partners here in Oregon that have taken on that charge. So we're going to come up with some clear path and strategies this year so that we can really make an impact and end veteran homelessness. And the second area that I'm excited about on the homeless arena is to really have a focus on the need for supportive housing. Supportive housing is a specialized, a really intentional housing approach that includes service-enriched housing for folks that have experienced chronic homelessness and have other critical needs. And really, it's a pretty intricate model that really relies on having the service providers and the housers work together. We need to learn more about that model. We need to engage our partners on best practices around those models. There are some great success stories here in Oregon. So we're pulling together partners to come up with some strategies and recommendations this year for how we can move that work forward and make an impact in that work in the coming years. On goal 5 is around our energy programs. And as we'll talk about today, you know, energy assistance is one of those critical areas that's linked to housing affordability. If you are able to effectively pay your energy costs or reduce your energy costs through weatherization, it really allows families to more comfortably be able to retain their housing and prevent folks from falling into housing insecurity. We have some exciting initiatives in our energy arena that really involve doing more robust outreach to provide energy bill pay assistance to folks that reside in our affordable housing so that we're making those connections, and also to provide energy improvements to transitional housing and homeless shelters to reduce the costs on those facilities so that they can serve more people and really retain their services in the long run in communities. Goal 6 has to do with home ownership. We have some very exciting work afoot in our single family home ownership programs. As we know, home ownership ultimately is the key to not only building assets, but building long-term stability for families. We have a goal to increase our single family bond loan production this year by 33% to $80 million. We expect, frankly, to blow through that and to exceed our goals. We have a lot of great work going on in our single family programs. We are working to engage additional lenders in the program. And we're also doing some work to really get at how we can reduce the minority home ownership gap in Oregon. And we have some great research going on and work going on with our partners to really identify strategies that are working and how we can replicate those strategies in other parts of the state. And finally, our work to prevent and resolve foreclosures. This has to do with our hardest hit programs, which is our Oregon Housing Stabilization Initiative, and the funding that we receive from U.S. Treasury, but also our work through the Oregon foreclosure avoidance programs. And, of course, if we can help folks avoid foreclosure and stay in their homes, we can stabilize communities and prevent folks from having to access our other services. So this is a very robust plan for the year, but honestly, it really captures the ongoing hard work of our staff. And so we're excited to be able to communicate that. And again, we are engaging in this long-term statewide housing plan, but we also have a plan and marching orders for ourselves for the year while we're completing that plan. So that's an exciting.
So thanks, Madam Chair. Margaret, I got a lot of questions for you on this, for what your seven goals are here, and I think that's really neat. I mean, you're moving, you push forward with an active word describing each one of them, so that's cool. Are these replacing your key performance measurements?
Thank you very much for the question, Representative and Chair. They are not replacing our key performance measures. Our key performance measures are still in place, and they really dovetail nicely with the key performance measures that we've been reporting on. So they don't replace those, they supplement them. Those key performance measures are good measures, they keep us on track, but for the day-to-day work and communication with our partners, we need to go further than that and have more detail, and that's what this plan does.
So, you know, Madam Chair, you and I and Representative Stark, we were in the subcommittee on this, you know, on Ways and Means for Human Services and OHP.
Well, actually, OHA, this one goes through, yes, we were for OHA and...
Yeah, OHA and DHS.
This goes through a different subcommittee.
Last time, I've never liked KPMs. Mm-hmm. I think they're worthless as far as I'm concerned. They have no meaning when it comes to outcome measurements. You're moving through these seven goals here toward, I mean, you're almost, to me, you're almost there with describing outcome measurements. The one that I thought was very fascinating, well, actually, you got several, but number six that you talked about, you actually wanted to see a 35% increase there for what you're wanting to do. That's a great look ahead on what you do. I did not catch how much money you were thinking that you needed from us in order for that to happen.
On goal six in particular?
Yes.
So that is our Oregon Residential Bond Loan Program, and we are not, I believe, asking for any additional resources for that program. Perhaps our CFO, Caleb Yant, can give some more detail on that.
Yeah, again, Caleb Yant, CFO for the agency. Yeah, that is a revenue bond program, so it's basically a market-driven product. And so and you'll get into a little bit more detail as I go through the numbers of the budget. But since basically 2008, when we've had historically low interest rates, our bond program hasn't been that competitive with market products. And so we've been able to stay viable, stay in the market, but at a much lower level of volume. And so as interest rates start to rise, our product becomes more viable. And so we have the opportunity to take some action and increase our volume there.
Okay, thanks. You know, this is good stuff, what you've done here. I mean, I really want to just say good job. My suggestion is not to limit it to 1 year, but actually as you move forward with your strategic planning to identify for a five-year plan and then just build as you move forward as you need to. But this is really good stuff.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Our thinking is that as we go through the statewide housing plan, the idea is that we'll actually be able to go deeper and do evidence-based decision-making, really looking at data of what the needs are in Oregon and thinking about what we might need to tweak on here or be more specific in terms of the outcomes or targets that we're trying to hit. I do have to just give one additional shout-out, which is that one of the things that makes me so proud about this plan is that it was entirely internally created. There were no outside, you know, experts, consultants, you know, high-priced folks coming in and doing this with us. This was really staff developed, and even the beautiful graphics that you see were created in-house. So that's just a wonderful thing for us from a management perspective as well. So very proud of the team.
Mm.
And now I'd like to hand things over to Caleb Yant to talk through our budget summary.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Director Salazar. Chair Kenita Geyer, members of the committee, again, Caleb Yant, Chief Financial Officer. So I'm going to spend probably the next 15 minutes or so just kind of going through the numbers of what actually is in our budget from a high level. So just a kind of a preview of what I'll walk through is I'm going to get into our budget by fund type. And so the degrees of magnitude of federal funds, other funds, and general fund. I'm also going to dive a little bit into some of the key state resources that go to our agency. Then I'll look at the same sort of high-level numbers, but from how the money is used. So whether it's used to pay debt service on our bonds or operating costs or program payments out to Oregonians. And then break that down to the different program areas that it goes through. And then finally, I'll go through some of the key risks related to our budget, not the least of which is the federal funding, but a few of those items that we're keeping a close eye on, and then some of the highlights from what is in the governor's budget. Excuse me. So by fund type, you could see at the highest level, the budget for OHCS is a $1.18 billion budget in the 2017-19 governor's budget. And that's broken out. I don't have the percentages here, but it's about 21% is federal funds. About 76% is other funds. And you could see on this chart that we broke that in between limited and non-limited. And just very quickly, I'll explain. We thought that was important because the limited is really the program payments. It is the document recording fee that I know this committee has heard about. It's some of the public purpose charge dollars that go to our agency and other funds. And that actually has gone up from 15-17 to 17-19. The non-limited is very much related to our bond program. It's debt service and those type of activities. And so it seemed important to break that out to show the difference there. And then we get about 2% general fund. Again, we broke that out. We have for the first time in this biennium general fund debt service that is related to the LIFT, the Article 11 Q bonds. And we wanted to break that out again so you kind of have an apples-to-apples comparison on 15-17 to 17-19. So you can see the general fund that is going to programs actually has gone down from 15-17 to what is in the 17-19 governor's budget. And very quickly, that is primarily related to the $10 million in EHA, Emergency Housing Assistance, and SHAP, the State Homeless Assistance Program, that we received in the 2016 legislative session, as well as Oregon foreclosure avoidance money, foreclosure mitigation counseling money, that was in the 15-17 budget that is not in the governor's budget for 17-19.
So that was one-time funding that went up for that rental assistance, homeless assistance, the EHA account.
Absolutely.
And the foreclosure.
Absolutely. And that's why we kind of wanted to break that out so you could see that. And then we have about 2%, a little less than 2%, is debt service on lottery bonds that we had previously received for preservation of affordable rental housing. So from the fund, you know, the type of funds that flow through our agency, that gives you a kind of a summary of that. Within those key funding, I want to highlight some of the key state funding that goes to our agency. So I know this committee has heard a lot about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, the lender tax credit program, and then the document recording fee, which are two very critical funding sources that go to our agency. As the slide says, the OAHTC program since 1989 has supported almost 17,000 units, 41% of which have gone to rural communities. And then related to the document recording fee, you might already know, but there's three primary programs. Well, there's three programs that this document recording fee is broken between at our agency. So 10% of that money goes to the Emergency Housing Assistance Program, which is a lot of the anti-poverty rental assistance, that type of work. We also get some general fund for that program. 14% of that goes to the Home Ownership Assistance Program, or HOPE program, and that really is for down payment assistance, as well as pre-purchase counseling and different work to help promote home ownership across Oregon. And then 76%, the lion's share, goes to the General Housing Account Program, which is really affordable housing development and preservation. It's flexible money that we really help leverage other resources like the federal tax credits to help develop this affordable rental housing. Just degree of magnitude on that general housing account, the 70s. No, go ahead.
Well, just a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back for a second. And what is the definition that you use for rural? Because you said that 40% was rural housing. How do we define rural in that? Do you know?
I don't know that.
We'll have to go back and double check that.
Yeah, if you could. I'm just curious because I know that that term can mean different things to different groups. So.
Right.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. The general housing account that was 76% has helped to construct or preserve more than 4,000 affordable homes in 55 towns or cities across Oregon. So just within the document recording fee, that's where the money goes and some of the outcomes. And again, we're going to get into the programs here when I hand it back to Margaret, and we'll be able to provide a little more information. There are other additional state resources that are key resources that go to our agency. So when we're talking about the fund types that go, it seemed relevant to point these out. Again, we're going to go into the programs here in a minute so we could provide some of the numbers behind this as we go through that. But there's the Emergency Housing Assistance and State Homeless Assistance Program that was mentioned previously. There's Elderly Rental Assistance. This is $1.5 million that is coming to our agency from the Department of Revenue. That's new this biennium. There's a Low Income Rental Housing Fund, the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance, which is a foreclosure mitigation counseling, as well as a variety of programs that come to us via the public purpose charge. So we don't get all of the public purpose charge, but we get some of it, and that helps support really four programs. The Housing Development Grant Program, that's an affordable rental housing development program. The money and the rules related to that money is very similar to the GHAP document recording fee dollars. There's Energy Conservation Helping Oregonians, Multifamily Low-Income Weatherization, which are weatherization for the single-family and multifamily side, and then Oregon Energy Assistance, which is really a bill payment assistance program. So those are some of the key state resources that go to our agency. This next slide is kind of getting into how the money is used. So same bottom line, about $1.18 billion budget, but this then says what goes to operating costs versus the program payments versus debt service and bond costs, and also has the employee count on it. One item I will note on here, and I certainly noted to our Ways and Means Subcommittee, is the thing that stands out to me is from 15-17 to 17-19, our operating costs went up by about $3 million at the same time that our program payments went down by about $30 million. So I just wanted to explain that quickly. From an operating cost perspective, the primary driver of that is the fact that there are 10 additional permanent positions in the governor's budget for 17-19. So six of those positions are really addressing some of the critical capacity staffing needs. There's some data research, there's multifamily underwriters, and then some single family positions to help really stand up and increase the volume of that Oregon bond program. And then four of those positions are related to new programs. So two of them are for the LIFT program, which again was new to us in 15-17, and two are for, one is the Elderly Rental Assistance and one is a HUD 811 program that we got. So that's the reason that went up. At the same time, of the about $32 million decrease in program payments, $27 million of that is attributable to one-time funding sources. So it's that EHA and SHAP, it's energy assistance that had a portion of the funding was phasing out in 2018, and then the Oregon foreclosure avoidance. So I just wanted to highlight that for the group. The next two slides, really kind of drill in a little bit more detail on how the money is used, but they exclude the bond costs and the debt service. And the reason that we wanted to do that is because we wanted to show of the funds that we really have decision-making ability on, what are those and what is the degree of magnitude? And maybe I'll just skip to this. It's not that obviously the bond cost and debt service is important. That's a key driver for us, is to make sure we maintain bond ratings and we have appropriate reserves. But we're going to pay our bills, and so we want to. This is looking at the portion of our budget where we have kind of more control over. And so this slide shows you of the $672 million that is related to that, kind of the key programmatic areas that goes towards. I think the one thing I will highlight here is the fact that there are a number of primarily tax credit programs that the federal low-income housing tax credit, the Oregon Affordable Housing tax credit, the individual development account, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, all tax credits that the money never goes through the accounts of OHCS, and so those dollars are not represented in our budget. And so just a kind of a side note, same with OHSI, the hardest hit funds of U.S. Treasury. We received a total of $315 million from them. In order to get that money, we had to create a not-for-profit that's associated with OHCS. The money doesn't flow through OHCS, so therefore it's not in our budget.
What is the name of that nonprofit?
It's the Oregon Affordable Housing Assistance Corporation.
Ooh.
So the last couple slides that I'll go over really speak to the budget drivers and risks, and then the kind of summary of key information in the governor's budget. So there's a few points to make in here. The first bullet point is talking about the federal tax credit markets causing financial gaps in pipeline projects. So this really is speaking to the low-income housing tax credit, the federal tax credit. There's a competitive side and a non-competitive side. We have a pipeline of over 30 projects that are in some phase of development in there, and they came in an application expecting to get a certain amount of investment from the investors, you know, for the tax credits, and because of the questions around corporate tax reform, the value of those tax credits, the amount that the investors are willing to pay, has gone down. So we have this pipeline of projects that thought they had a viable project, and then now there's a funding gap. And so we're working really closely with our Housing Stability Council and with stakeholders. We're very much committed to making sure those projects in our pipelines are able to be constructed, are able to be built. But that certainly is something where, yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's been some publicity the last week or so about the, you know, that program, how it's been run, effectiveness of it, basically corruption, et cetera. And some of my, you know, thoughts came to mind is, how does Oregon manage any of those projects? And, you know, what type of oversight do we have with those to make sure that, you know, it, basically it's not... It's all going to the right, you know, purpose.
Certainly, Representative and Madam Chair, thank you for the question. We've been working on this quite a bit and taking a hard look at our programs to make sure that we can appropriately address these questions. You know, the low-income housing tax credit has been the largest producer of affordable housing in the last 30 years nationally, as well here in Oregon. Low-income housing tax credit has financed more than 41,000 homes for low-income households. On average, we're producing about 1,400 homes each year through that program, so it's been tremendously successful. It is a public-private partnership. So one of the things that we've heard through some recent publicity is a concern about the number of units in through the low-income housing tax credit. The unit production has been decreasing. And so we've taken a look at our numbers to understand if that's true. We don't really see that trend here in Oregon. A couple of the drivers of that, one is that the land costs have increased. And so certainly the cost of housing development, because land costs are increasing, has contributed to that. In Oregon, we've also intentionally looked at high opportunity areas, so really trying to site affordable housing in areas where families have proximity to jobs, transit, services, and other opportunities, so that we're not locking families out of, you know, good schools and other opportunities to get on their feet. When you do site housing in high opportunity areas, it can be more expensive, and so naturally you're going to see less units per credit. That's a trade-off that we have to confront for sure. 39% of the projects that we've been financing are in those high opportunity areas since we made that sort of intentional push. So you can really see that does kind of bear out in our outcomes. The other thing that we wanted to explain is that, you know, one of the reasons why there's fewer units being produced in Oregon and nationally per credit is because we are intentionally trying to focus on lower income households. And when you do that, it costs more per unit to house those families. Again, that's a trade-off that we're trying to confront in terms of trying to reach the folks that are the hardest hit and at the lowest incomes. And I believe we have data that shows that 48% of all the households living in our low-income housing tax credit properties are extremely low income. So they're earning 30% or less than median income. So that's just to sort of explains, that's one of the critiques of the program. The other critique as well has to do with the issues of fraud, the concerns of corruption, and, you know, really the implication that funds are flowing to developers and to investors that aren't entitled to those. So we've taken a hard look at our own, you know, developer fees, which are in line with the program allowances. We've taken strides to make sure that developers are not getting more profit from these properties than they would be getting in a market rate development. So we take that very seriously. And in terms of the sort of construction costs, one of the other concerns raised was whether the construction costs are being artificially inflated. We have a team of folks that are very focused on compliance. I think one of the things that has not been explained is how much we check those construction costs and line items. And in fact, if anything, we've been critiqued by our partners for being a little bit too focused on the kind of line by line, double checking those costs. But I think we're pretty confident that because of those tight oversight practices, that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen any instances of fraud in the program here in Oregon. But, you know, we appreciate the questions.
Thank you. And follow up? Mm-hmm. Because what I've seen is I work with builders, developers, and investors, and some of the questions that are coming up is that why is it costing, I guess, our developers, builders, $400 a square foot, where the same type of community that they're going to be renting for $2,000 a month is costing half that amount, and that's all private build out. So, and I know they're you know, everybody, when you're building it for yourself, you're cutting all the fat, you're doing it as efficient and as economically as possible. So it just frustrates me that, and how can I support and quantify these where same community, same land, same, that it's $400 a square foot, it's $200 a square foot here. Right. So
thank you for the question again. And we, first, I just want to acknowledge that when you look at these affordable housing developments, the first thing that I think often hits folks is that sticker shock of why the differential. And so we dig into this quite a bit. So in our key performance measures, we are proposing a change this year from total development costs to construction costs, because we think that's a better comparison of apples to apples. Because in the affordable housing world, the development costs, you have to pay that extra cost because you're trying to subsidize those rents. And so if you're trying to serve families that are 30% median income and below, you can't do that by raise the rents in order to cover those costs and sort of get additional debt on the property to be able to make those deals pencil out. So that's kind of the biggest issue. When you do bring in public dollars, there are strings attached as well that can add cost to these developments. And that's sort of those soft costs that are hard to kind of articulate to in the market rate space. But everything from environmental reviews to the very robust oversight that we're doing adds cost to the development process. So
fundraising costs to put all these streams
fundraising
together.
Fundraising costs, cobbling together the housing. So it's a different business model that our nonprofit developers are using to get these built. Is it the most efficient model of building housing? It may not be. It is the most effective tool that we have right now. I think we're confident that we're managing that tool very well. But I would say that's another reason why we and others here at the state have been looking very keenly at the issue of cost containment and new innovative strategies. And that's why we're excited about programs such as LIFT, which really focuses on cost containment and using a non-9% tax credit model. So we're looking at other ways that we can get housing on the ground that doesn't use that low-income housing tax credit, because it can be kind of a clunky tool. that can be expensive to use, and it's the right tool for the right job in some instances, but it may not be the right fit for every community or every type of housing. So we're looking at this very carefully.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, because that's the, you know, we're trying to be good stewards of our dollars, and we're hearing these fat cats saying, yeah, we buy these all the time. I'm making $1 million this year versus last year, whatever. And it's just, it's frustrating to hear that.
Yeah. No,
so thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it's been one of our few tools that we've had at all up until the LIFT program for construction. But I also just wanted to follow up on that question in terms of the 30 projects. So the credits are worth less because corporations are thinking that they might get a tax break on their corporate income tax at the federal level and not buying into this market as much, right? That's why.
Yes.
And it used to be how much per dollar that we got. It was like more than a dollar that we would get for the dollar that we extended, and now it's down to 85 cents or something like that.
Madam Chair, that's approximately, and it varies. So the pricing for tax credit is a market-driven process. In some parts of the country, like we've talked to our friends in the San Francisco Bay Area, those credits are worth over $1, $1.15. Mm-hmm. It's a different market than it would be, for example, in rural Oregon. So it's always fluctuates, and it always depends on the market. We were seeing in the Portland metro area about 95 cents on a dollar, and now down to about 85 cents, 80 cents. In rural Oregon, it's maybe potentially a little lower than that. So we're monitoring this carefully. It's fluctuating even as we speak.
And it gets reset every year. And so you've got projects out there that are depending on this, and there's less of income from the tax credits coming in.
They negotiate the pricing when they are putting that deal together when they get to the closing table. So it doesn't necessarily get reset every year, but it's all those projects that had not yet closed that were in the development pipeline that are impacted.
I see. And so now they have less funds available to them, but they haven't broken ground.
That's right.
Okay.
So the second bullet point on there is talking about Oregon volunteers and the court-appointed special advocates. So Margaret briefly mentioned how, you know, there was a one-time investment in 2015-17 to help cover some of the operational costs that exceeded the amount of funding they received. Oregon Volunteers and CASA are both very strong mission-driven organizations, and that mission isn't directly in alignment with the mission of OHCS. They have been with OHCS for a number of years, a number of biennia, and that's kind of a temporary home. And there's a lot of active conversations that are occurring, right now as to where the best place for them is. So we're engaged in those conversations, and it's certainly something that could impact our budget because it's in there now, and we're not sure if it will be in
17-18. And if it got removed from your budget, how would that impact you?
It would, so as of right now, in the absence of general fund to help cover the operational costs, there is a operating deficit for these programs. So it would essentially remove that unfunded
mandate. Save you money.
Mandate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. The next bullet point is new legislation and programs that could stretch the capacity of our existing staff. And I know this committee knows a lot about that because you've heard a lot of these bills. You'll hear more as we walk through our presentation related, the bills related to each program area. But at the highest level, right now, there currently still is about 36 bills that could impact OHCS that are active, 4 task forces. And within those 36, there's about 17 that either add a new program to us or significantly alter the funding or the change the program with OHCS. And so, obviously, we're keeping a close eye on that legislation. And as I go through the numbers of FDE count and dollars, depending on where that legislation goes, that could have an impact on our budget.
But the fiscals would include the FDE to cover those.
Correct. Right. That is not included in the governor's budget, obviously, but correct. As the fiscals have been coming along, we've been assessing and including that. And then the final bullet point here is uncertainty regarding federal funding. And so there's a couple slides here. I'm not going to go over all the numbers, but I'll just stay at this.
I think you should.
Maybe I should go
Maybe
over all the numbers.
Maybe we buried the lead a little bit, because this is a pretty big impact
it's a big,
for us. Yeah.
So at the highest level, and I'll add one more that's not even on here. So the 2018 presidential budget blueprint, the impact on our agency's programs would be a reduction of $111 million in federal funds that are currently going to our agency that would not be going to our agency. What is not on here is the HUD performance-based contract administration. That's project-based vouchers. That's a contract we hold to administer that program for the state. And HUD is currently looking at the possibility of moving that contract from a state level to a regional or possibly a national level. That's another $124 million that's in our budget that is not included here. And so between the 111 that you see here, and then I'll walk through quickly the programs underneath it, and that 124, which is also kind of a question mark, we're obviously actively engaged in monitoring to see if that procurement is going to come out and to respond to that. That's $225 million in federal funds. And I'll just note from a couple slides ago, our total federal funds for 17-19 are $245 million. So the vast majority of our federal funds are in some state of flux. Obviously, huge impact to our budget and something we're keeping a very close eye on.
And if I may just add on to that, as we've tried to understand the potential impact of these programs, which are slated not just for cuts but for elimination at the federal level, we have quantified that that would equate to 364,000 vulnerable Oregonians who receive some form of assistance through these programs that would not have that assistance available to them. And as we talk through the presentation in a little bit more detail, as we turn to the remaining slides, you know, we leverage these federal dollars with the state funds that we are lucky enough to receive. So, you know, that impacts how much we can do with our state funding as well. In order to have a full, robust program, we really have relied on this. So we just wanted the committee to be aware of this sort of potential crisis, frankly, that's hanging over our agency and our partners, and how doubly important the state resources are now that we have this uncertainty to face.
Absolutely. And as Director Salazar pointed out, most of these programs are just slated for elimination, not cuts, but just full elimination. So the community services block grant, the home program, which is the tenant-based assistance, and there's also a development side of it, the Department of Energy weatherization program. A huge one for us is the low-income energy assistance program. So that's weatherization for low-income Oregonians at $9 million, and then energy assistance, bill payment assistance at $62.8 million. Again, just slated for elimination. Home I already talked about, but this is the $14.2 million in the development side of kind of the federal funds. And then that's the Oregon Volunteers, a corporation for national community services that I mentioned a minute ago, but that is an additional $7 million that's slated to be completely eliminated in that budget framework.
Yes, question, Madam Chair.
Yes, sure.
So, Caleb, on the previous slide, the last two pieces are essentially the same thing, just different route. Anybody ever done any homework on that, what the savings are by those two programs?
As far as the savings for the households served,
yes.
I think we'll get
into a little bit of that in our presentation. And if we don't fully answer that question, we can do some follow-ups. But yes, we do have that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, we're in control of your budget here, right? I mean,
and when it goes 2,000, is it the same 2,000 households?
Sure.
No, I think the money is used in slightly different ways, and so that'd be 2,000 from the Department of Energy and 2,000 from
total 4,000 households.
Total of 4,000 between the two, exactly. And again, just like our other resources, we use the state resources. So ECHO is the part of the public purpose charge that does similar work with the low-income weatherization of households. And a lot of these projects, single-family projects, we're able to use federal funds for a certain part of it and then state funds for another part of it. And so it really, it's pairing the different funding sources to be able to do a complete job.
So I just want to go back. So $111 million or more. And then what was the HUD number?
It was $124 million. And that,
that's for the vouchers.
That's for the project-based vouchers. Yeah, okay. You can see Section that eight, on performance-based contract administration, maybe the third line down, 124, 126 there.
Okay. And so we would lose that much, 235.
That the impact to our budget would be that, okay. Yes.
Thank you.
235 from 245, so it'd leave you with 10 million.
About, yeah.
Right. And I think that essentially would equate to the low-income housing tax credit program would be that's the only item that's not on the chopping block.
Yeah, I think there's a few
other smaller
things. Federal sources of federal funds, but yeah, it would 99% would be gone.
And is that about what the federal low-income housing tax credit is, about 10 million a year?
It's a little more than that. We'll have to go back and look at this in detail.
Yeah, and just to clarify on that federal tax credit, those tax credits don't run through our budget, so the portion of the tax credit that hits our budget is just the cost of administration. Right. So.
But do you know about how much that is that we get through the...
Yes, it is... it's through a formula, so it does fluctuate based on population. But for 9%, the most recent year is $8.75 million, and 4% is just subject to the private activity bond cap. So it's been $12.2 million in recent years. But
the federal?
For the federal, yep.
A year.
So big risks. Mm-hmm. And it makes our job hard. Final slide here is just some of the highlights from the governor's budget. So there's three kind of areas that we wanted to highlight. One is investments to leverage private equity and federal funds. So there's $60 million in the governor's budget of additional LIFT. That's the Article 11Q bonds. And we're going to have a case study here in a few minutes when Margaret goes through, and we kind of get an idea when we talk about leveraging the federal funds. You'll see how these LIFT funds worked with the federal tax credit to bring in that private equity.
You skipped one slide, I think, before that.
Yeah.
That one, okay.
Sorry. It's just the additional federal funding cuts.
So it's a third energy assistance program. Mm-hmm.
This one is bill payment assistance as opposed to weatherization.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah, thank you.
So there's an additional LIFT investment in the governor's budget, and then there's also $10 million in lottery bonds that is within the governor's budget. We noted there with flexibility in use. Historically, OHCS has received lottery bonds for preservation of affordable housing that's at risk of losing its federal subsidy. This certainly could be used for that. What is noted in the governor's budget is these lottery bonds could also be used for manufactured park preservation, as well as kind of flexible gap financing to be paired with the federal tax credit. So that's the two substantial investments in the governor's budget. The second bullet point there is funding at current service level. So these are funds, general fund, that did not take a reduction from current service level in the governor's budget. So they remained at that level for emergency housing assistance, state homeless assistance, low-income rental housing fund, and then the elderly rental.
Without the bump up that we gave last year because of the emergency.
Correct. The one-time funding
goes
went
back
away.
To the normal, right.
Exactly.
And could you say how much those are? I think EHA is $5 million a year.
It's that we have it on the slides here. When we get to the program, each of those will be detailed out. And then the third bullet really speaks to the staffing that I kind of highlighted earlier. But there's two permanent positions for the LIFT program, and then a total of six positions between data and research. So two positions at data and research, two within multifamily, and two within single family. So those are the investments from a position perspective that are in the governor's budget.
Six in data and research.
Six total. I apologize.
Multifamily? No.
Six total between data and research, multifamily, and single family. So two in each. And now I will turn it back to Director Salazar to get into the programs.
Thank you very much. So I will now turn to some detail on some of the specific programs. We go through, I think, the major areas of focus for the agency. So first, we just wanted to let you know a little bit about how we see our work and how we're structured, sort of as a continuum. For housing stability, we have two sides of our house internally, housing finance and housing stabilization. And they really are intended to work together. So the concept is housing finance sort of helps to finance those housing opportunities, whether it's through down payment assistance and providing below market rate mortgage opportunities for home buyers, on our rental housing side, financing the development and preservation of affordable rental housing, or even helping folks avoid foreclosure through mortgage restructuring and mortgage payment assistance. On our housing stabilization side, what we really see here is the continuum of providing those services and those ancillary benefits to help folks be able to stay in their homes, to have a stable household budget, and to address poverty issues. But we also have, in our housing stabilization arena, the programs to help prevent and reduce homelessness. So together, the concept is that we will be able to help folks stay in their homes and not have to then access that the need to produce new affordable housing. So it's part of a whole continuum. So we're going to start today by talking about the housing stabilization programs. And these are programs that are, again, designed to help stabilize at-risk Oregonians by providing homeless services, energy services, asset building programs, and performance-based contract administration, which is that HUD contract that we've been talking about. So a few highlights that we wanted to start with on the homeless services side. So again, here we leverage state and federal funds, and what we've done here is break out for you the state funding as well as the federal funding to prevent and end homelessness for Oregonians. So the key state programs, of course, EHA, which is general fund and document recording fee, outreach to homeless persons, providing shelters, homeless prevention, rapid rehousing, and other uses. SHAP, which is, of course, general fund, street outreach, facility operations, resident support services, and LRF, which is general fund rental assistance, security deposits, and rapid rehousing. So a little bit more detail on some outcomes from those programs. In fiscal year 2016, we provided homeless assistance to more than 27,096 people across the state. And a few things that we wanted to highlight, you know, so the prevention activities for homeless services are really critical. If you can think about that kind of modest investment to help someone from becoming homeless and entering that cycle of homelessness, that is a very cost-effective intervention. So we were able to prevent more than 4,800 individuals from falling into homelessness last year. If you really think about downstream, the savings to the emergency rooms, other sorts of services, and really the trauma of experiencing homelessness, that is a critical investment. Rapid rehousing is a similar kind of intervention, which is that folks that really experience that short-term episode of homelessness, being able to quickly get them rehoused before sort of that cascading effect of the trauma of homelessness sets in. That's another very critical program. You know, through our outreach activities, our community action agency partners are out on the street finding homeless individuals and connecting them to services. And then, of course, providing those critical shelter opportunities as well. In addition to those core homeless services, we wanted to highlight a few other activities. So the Elderly Rental Assistance Program is a new program that's coming over to our agency from the Department of Revenue. It's a recognition that historically elderly individuals have been able to receive a tax rebate at the end of the year to help them pay their expenses, but there was a recognition that we could really use those resources to help target those needy seniors who are experiencing homelessness and get them back into housing. And so we are standing up a new program to target approximately 300 individuals and get them into into safe and stable housing with those program funds that have now come over to our agency. So we're launching that, I believe, in July is when that program will take effect. The Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program, of course, is connected to the Section 8 rent assistance. Folks that have Section 8 vouchers, that's that guarantee program to really provide that incentive to landlords to rent to those Section 8 residents. We administer that. The Housing Plus program is providing services to affordable housing. And of course, we also use the federal funds, the Community Services Block Grant Program, and the Home Tenant Based Assistance to augment those efforts as well. So I mentioned that the Elderly Rental Assistance is a new program that will be standing up this summer. EHA and SHAP, again, are being proposed at the current service level, and that's moving on from the one-time additional funding of $10 million for those programs. And the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program in the governor's recommended budget is reduced 12% from the current service level.
So can I ask a question here? You're presenting the governor's budget. You are an agency of the governor, so I recognize you're in a particular situation here where you can't not advocate for her budget. But I'm curious about, given that EHA and SHAP are going back to the previous levels without the bump up for to handle the crisis, and I know, you know, the community I represent, we still have many homeless on the streets. I think the metro area, we had a presentation by Mark Jolin earlier in which they showed how they've opened three new shelters. They've absorbed so many more people. They've helped people prevent people from going into homeless, and yet we're only partially solving the problem, and so they are desperate. And so I'm just curious, when you say this is presented at the current service level, meaning before the bump up, before it was doubled, to go back to that level, do you have any sense of what percent of the need that would cover?
You know, Chair, appreciate the question. We'd have to look at those numbers. I mean, I think we understand that we are not serving the folks that are currently in need of homeless services. I mean, that's evident, whether it's the need to create new shelters or additional rental assistance or find creative ways to tie rental assistance to permanent housing opportunities. There's a lot of opportunity there, and there's a great deal of need. And I think particularly when we're looking at the specter of federal budget cuts, we know how critical those resources are. So we know that we're not meeting the full need. I don't think we have a good handle at this moment on what percentage of the need we're meeting. We can try to look at that and get back to the committee. So we know that the committee has looked at a number of bills related to our various programs. I'm inviting Ariel Nelson, our legislative liaison here. As we go through each program, we will highlight a few of the bills that are pending this session that may touch on these programs, and she will be available to answer any questions that you might have. A couple of the things that we wanted to highlight here is there are some bills, of course, pending related to the rent guarantee program. This was a rent guarantee program that had been in existence, particularly helpful for our local housing authorities to really help folks be able to use their vouchers. You know, we've talked at this committee about the very, heartbreaking trend of folks, you know, waiting for a Housing Choice voucher, Section 8 voucher. They receive their voucher and then they aren't able to use it because there's just such a scarcity of vacant units. This rent guarantee program was something that the housing authorities really spoke with us about how critical it is for them to be able to help those vulnerable tenants get into housing, whether they're Section 8 or whether they're non-Section 8 residents, to be able to house folks that are in need of the housing. So we know that that's something that the committee has looked at. And there's also a proposed change to the Landlord Choice Guarantee Program as well. So we know there are a number of homeless and housing stabilization bills on the list, and happy to answer any questions about those.
I have a question about why some are bolded. Does that indicate something else?
The bolded, Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Ariel Nelson, Government Relations Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Yes, the bolded font indicates if it's a new program, something that we don't already have.
Or renewed.
Correct. Not a current existing program.
Right. And so you'll see those as we go through the programs, that there are certain bills that are bolded, and that's what those bolds represent.
And the first one reminds me of something I meant to ask on a previous slide, where you had $12 million for I think it was EHA, and $17 million in federal funds. To what extent, if we put more money into EHA, might that leverage federal funds? Does it change at all, or does it $17 million? Because I think this Senate Bill 821 had something to do with providing more opportunities for federal match.
I think one of the areas where we can look at that is in the veterans homeless arena. We know that there's the resource of VASH vouchers that we could better kind of utilize by linking the state and the federal resources together. And I know we've heard from our friends at ODVA about the need for getting more veterans benefits on the ground here in Oregon. So I think that's one opportunity where we might be able to see how that additional investment of state resources and staff on the ground could help to bring in additional federal dollars. So I can move on now to our asset building program. So the Individual Development Account Program is a program that helps individuals and families with low incomes through matched savings accounts, and also provides financial education. And this is really a poverty alleviation strategy to help folks to build savings and also to get that financial education so that they can move towards self-sufficiency. The program has been hugely successful, and I can just say that nationally, Oregon is really a model state for the IDA program. Over the last 3 years, more than 2,600 IDA participants have reached their savings goals. The average savings was more than $2,100 per participant, totaling $5.8 million of savings that we can, I think, confidently say would not have occurred without this program. Also, through financial education programs, there have been really great outcomes as we've evaluated the program. More participants indicate that they have a knowledge of how to access and use a savings account, create emergency budgets, and other financial tools.
So, the question, for every dollar that somebody saves, how much is matched from the federal and or state?
I will have to take a look at that detail about exactly how that match works. We work through neighborhood partnerships, which works then with fiduciary organizations across the state of Oregon that set up these plans. So we'll take a look at exactly how those matches work. There are a number of specific uses for IDAs: home purchase, education, small business startup, home repair, purchase equipment, and more recently, purchasing a vehicle, which can be such a critical strategy for low-income families to be able to access jobs or other services, replacement of a primary residence, or energy efficiency. I will note here, you asked about the federal resources, so we just got word that the federal program Assets for Independence, which is through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has been eliminated for fiscal year 17. So the federal fiscal year 17 budget was just passed, and those federal funds will no longer be coming to Oregon. Of course, folks are looking ahead at what that means for fiscal year 18, but I will say that we expect that to be a loss, a considerable loss, and we're still taking a look at the direct impact, but anywhere from $1 to $4 million that will no longer be coming to these IDA accounts for the state of Oregon. And our partners are taking a look at what that will mean for their programs on the ground. I'll move on now to weatherization. So we had a couple of questions around weatherization and energy efficiency. We'll do our best to try to answer those questions. So in the 2017-2019 governor's budget, the key programs here, the Energy Conservation Helping Oregonians, or ECHO program, and the Multifamily Low-Income Weatherization program are proposed. And you can see, again, that historically we've matched those with Department of Energy and LIHEAP and Bonneville Power Administration programs for both weatherization, and then later we'll talk about the bill payment assistance. So we had a question about the weatherization programs and how much savings those are yielding. The projected annual energy savings for our weatherization programs are over $1 million. So the funding sources here: public purpose charge, energy conservation helping Oregonians, $9.8 million, and the multifamily low-income weatherization public purpose charge at $272,000.
We are really pushing hard to expand our weatherization activity. Just this spring, we've inked a contract with a nationally known firm that has worked with other states to be able to market these weatherization programs in multifamily properties, whether it's new construction or preserving existing affordable housing, to be able to really aggressively engage in weatherization activities, reduce their energy costs, and to be able to shore up those properties and make critical improvements to the property infrastructure. And I can just say weatherization, you know, when you think about the impact on individual households, you know, for homeowners in particular, a lot of times these are elderly folks, these are folks with aging homes. Being able to make these weatherization improvements at the front end really does save them on the back end, the monthly costs. But it also helps us, another related benefit is the health and safety improvements. You know, we do a lot of repairs to things like manufactured homes or aging single-family homes that have folks that need, you know, accessibility upgrades, and they need things like ramps, and they need other health and safety improvements that really, again, help folks to be able to stay comfortably in their homes through the weatherization services that we provide. Next, we'll talk about bill payment assistance. So bill payment assistance is really a lifeline for vulnerable Oregonians who cannot afford to pay their utility bills. So the Oregon Energy Assistance Program in the 2017-2019 governor's budget is proposed at $35.5 million, and then we match that again with LIHEAP, which is the federal low-income home energy assistance program funding. Some outcomes here. So for fiscal year 2016, we assisted more than 81,000 households and more than 20 first-time program users. So, you know, it's and when you look at total people served, so including families, it's over 200,000 people. So really has been a huge help for so many Oregonians who are struggling. And as we think about the really harsh winter that we all just endured, this has been a critical program. And the funds, I'm told by our team, are being fully utilized this year and then some. We have a great demand for these resources given the great need for heating expenses this
winter. Are people turned away?
I think in some community action agencies, people are turned away. It really varies from, you know, locality to locality. So there are a few legislative changes to energy services. One of the items we wanted to mention is the proposed transfer of the State Home Oil Weatherization, or SHOW, program from the Department of Energy to OHCS. So that is something that is being proposed this session. Any questions? Okay, and then finally on the stabilization side of the house, I'll mention the performance-based contract administration. So again, this is the contract that we have with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We have a contract with HUD to do the oversight and asset management of the HUD-assisted properties in the state of Oregon. So we talked a little bit about the level of that contract. HUD is rebidding that contract this year. We will be participating in that, but we are at risk of potentially losing that contract. So we're entering into some regional partnerships with our colleagues in other states to see how we can work together to try to retain those contracts. We also have the HUD Section 811 Project Rental Assistance Program. This is a rental assistance program particularly to serve folks with persistent mental illness and intellectual developmental disabilities. This is project-based assistance, so the idea is to put these rental assistance resources into existing properties or new properties, but tie them to the properties so that those resources are available for permanent housing opportunities for folks with these special needs. So now I'll move on to our housing finance programs. So as I mentioned, these are programs that are designed to increase and retain the stock of affordable housing and to increase homeownership opportunities. So we have robust programs for multifamily development and preservation, single-family housing programs, homeownership stabilization, and then as part of that, of course, we have the asset management and compliance. So after the properties are built, we do the long-term oversight of the health of those properties and compliance of those properties with all of our requirements, as well as the debt management activities for the bond programs to support all the financing needed for these opportunities. So just highlighting again that the additional funding requests in the governor's recommended budget this year, $60 million roughly for the local innovation and fast track housing or LIFT program, and $10 million requested in lottery bonds for affordable housing preservation.
Can you say something about the difference between using general obligation bonds and lottery bonds? Why one and not the other?
The general obligation bonds, maybe you can speak a little bit to this too, but the LIFT is using a unique structure, which is the Article 11Q bonds, which are typically used for things like infrastructure. So it's a little bit of a different resource for us. It requires state involvement either in the ownership or long-term operation of the properties. So we're setting up a new structure for LIFT. It's the first time we've done this, but it doesn't require the state to be engaged in the properties in a different way, which is again why we need the additional staffing to be able to monitor the properties in a more robust and different fashion than our typical asset management, and to ensure that we're adequately setting up the ownership and management structure for those properties. And Caleb, did you want to add anything on that?
I think the only thing that I would add is, that lottery bonds are oversubscribed. And so going into 15-17, this came in as part of the governor's budget at $100 million at that time as a new source of funding for affordable housing, knowing that there is a limited amount that could come out of lottery-backed bonds.
So lottery bonds are more flexible, but we just don't have very much of them.
Right. Okay. So now I'll talk a little bit more detail about multifamily housing development and preservation. We talked a little bit earlier specifically about the low-income housing tax credit program, some of the questions about that program. And we've talked a little bit as well about the pricing issues, so I won't dwell on those details at this point. But I'll just mention that we administer the federal low-income housing tax credit. Those credits are provided to us by the United States Department of Treasury. The 9% low-income housing tax credit is a competitive program that we put out annually through a notice of funding availability. We award credits to project sponsors who then typically syndicate or sell those to investors who then provide equity to the project. So they bring in private resources that otherwise would not be involved in affordable housing development, which really allows the leverage of that federal tax resource with private investment. The 4% program is a non-competitive program. We are limited only by the level of private activity bonds. I'm very, very excited to say that, one of the goals of OHCS and, frankly, state housing agencies around the country has been to ramp up that 4% activity. Really, given that we understand that we're not meeting the need for affordable rental housing, we're only housing about one quarter of the folks that need affordable housing. And folks have looked at the 4% credit and said, wow, this is an underutilized program. How can we ramp this up? That was a big focus of our agency as well. Last year, we closed about 4%. I believe it was a total of 4% transactions, which is good. This year, we have 22 projects in the pipeline. So we're really, really excited about the interest in using the 4% program. A lot of that is attributed to the new resources of LIFT and other state resources that we've been able to leverage, the gap financing, to get those projects done.
We put them together.
And again, because it's a non-competitive federal resource, it is a very valuable asset to us. And so if we can find ways to leverage those state resources to make that program work, it benefits everybody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so I think the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit was one of those other functions that we were able to help fill the gap.
That's right. Yes, we do often pair the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit with these federal tax credits.
Great.
Thank you.
Madam.
4% is competitive. The Oregon
is competitive.
Is competitive, yes.
Yeah.
Those are just the federal ones, yes.
Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, I just wanted to speak to Rep. Gorsuch's earlier question about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. You had asked where the 41% to rural communities came from.
Yeah.
For that particular analysis, we came from 50,000 or less was what for that summary.
50,000 population.
Yeah, but for our actual programs, depending on state or federal, we have different definitions of rural. For example, LIFT is 25,000 and below. But it was a really great question. It's something that our Housing Stability Council has been discussing. You know, some federal resources and have different measures, you know, if it's single family versus multifamily. And it's definitely something that I could see being addressed through our state housing plan as we look at the need and how to target resources around the state.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
I believe that maybe it's U.S. Census. They go all the way down to like 2,500. In a community. So that's why I was wondering, when we use the term rural a lot, but the question is, are we all on the same page? And I think we're not.
It's a great discussion.
And I think the response is we're not all on the same page. Yeah. And we need to look at that carefully. And our partners, I think, are eager to have that conversation because, you know, where you set that limit has huge
implications. Yeah, it does, right.
I appreciate that question. A couple of other items I wanted to mention, major resources for multifamily development and preservation. So the Federal Home Investment Partnership Program, $14.2 million assumed for our biennium. That is typically used in a lot of rural or smaller communities. We administer what's called the balance of state. So these are federal resources that go to states as well as local jurisdictions, but the local jurisdictions have to meet a certain threshold in terms of population and other factors. So there are some participating jurisdictions in Oregon, but we also cover a lot of the terrain of the state where the cities are not large enough to receive their own allocation of home.
This is the one that you said that you're going to run out of money in the first few months of this year?
This is the program that is slated for elimination in 2018, the federal program.
But I also wrote something down when you were talking about expanding home ownership. Was that the HOPE program?
This is the HOME program. This is for...
Is that different from HOPE?
Yes.
Okay.
HOME is for affordable housing development and preservation. It also has a tenant-based component, which we mentioned during the homeless services conversation for rental assistance. And then the Federal Housing Trust Fund is actually a new federal resource that is funded through receipts from Fannie and Freddie through the discussion about those government-sponsored enterprises at the federal level. So we received our first grant agreement for this program, and we anticipate having $6 million in these federal funds to allocate. So we'll start allocating those for the first time in winter of 2018. So this next slide gives you a sense of the scale of what we do. I won't go through all of the dollar amounts because it can be a little misleading because often we do leverage these resources together. But what I can tell you is that last year through these programs, we were able to provide permanent housing opportunities to more than 2,800 families across the state of Oregon. So, you know, we definitely see the bang for the buck when you think about providing that permanent infrastructure of affordable housing on the ground. We know that there are a number of bills on the table this session related to multifamily housing. So we have a couple of slides here. A couple of things that we wanted to just call out that we're watching carefully. So one is, of course, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit proposal to not only extend the sunset, but also potentially increase the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit and allow some new tools to invest those resources and bring additional revenue through that tax credit for affordable housing development and preservation. We're also looking at the Affordable Housing Land Acquisition Revolving Loan Fund Program, which we know has been of great interest to many of our partners. This is a proposal that is modeled after a successful program in the state of Washington. We've talked to our colleagues at the Washington State Housing Finance Commission to learn a little bit about how they do land acquisition and how they found it to be a valuable tool to get land in the pipeline for affordable housing development. And then, of course, we're watching carefully on this page, the preservation, the first item, which is Speaker Kotek's proposed bill, which would expand laws regarding preservation of participating properties. You know, we are looking a lot at preservation. It was called out in the Secretary of State's performance audit. So, you know, we see this as a potential interesting opportunity that would allow us to really stand up a robust preservation program to be able to address that need. Any questions about those? I know you all are very familiar with those bills. So I just wanted to, on this next slide, give you a sense of our inventory and our reach across the state. I think often folks may have a misunderstanding or have assumptions that our affordable housing is really concentrated in the most urban areas of the state. But if you look at this map, it really shows you that as a percentage of total rental units, we have a touch really in all counties of the state, including some rural areas that you might be surprised to see what an impact our housing is having as a portion of the housing market. So we just wanted to give you a sense of where our properties are located. Now I want to switch gears and talk specifically about LIFT. We've mentioned LIFT a couple of times, but just for a little bit of a review, in 2015, the Oregon Legislature committed $40 million of general obligation Article 11Q bonds to the LIFT program. The primary goals of LIFT are, number one, to create a large number of new affordable housing units to serve low-income Oregonians, and number two, to serve historically underserved communities, either rural communities with less than 25,000 people and population, or communities of color, which have been underserved as well. The secondary goals of LIFT were to place affordable housing units in service as quickly as possible, to serve families earning at or below 60% of area median income, receiving services through DHS, and to identify innovative building strategies that result in lower costs of affordable housing development that is replicable. So we were able to make LIFT awards in January of 2017. We made awards to 12 projects, half in rural communities and half in urban communities. 919 total units of housing will be developed through this resource, so we're thrilled that we have that much of a reach. And I think, as I mentioned, you know, a number of these projects, the majority of them are also proposing to leverage the LIFT funds with that underutilized federal 4% tax credit. So we're thrilled that we can pair those resources together, that the LIFT funds are able to bring in private investment and federal investment to get housing in the ground in Oregon. And some really interesting partnerships that we're seeing as well with DHS to be able to serve these families. I'll talk a little bit. I have a case study I'll present on LIFT in a moment. But first, the Mental Health Housing Program. In 2015, OHCS received $20 million in proceeds from lottery-backed bonds to be used for housing development. And there was a budget note that directed OHCS and our friends at the Oregon Health Authority to partner in awarding these funds to projects targeting individuals with serious mental illness or addiction disorders. We made an initial round of awards to the Mental Health Housing Program last fall. As you can see, five worthy projects doing really interesting work. We heard from our stakeholders that there was an interest in making the program more flexible and streamlined to be able to reach additional applications. So we retooled the NOFA. We put those funds back out this winter, and we have just now closed the application cycle. We're still doing the scoring. We are excited about some of the projects that we're looking at. Of course, it's too soon to be able to make any announcements today. I will say that we do anticipate having some funds that will remain available after this application process closes. And so we're working again with OHA to think about creative ways to put the remaining resources back out there. We're thinking about things such as maybe an innovation pilot to look at innovative models for serving these folks. We're also thinking about leveraging the mental health dollars with our upcoming veterans NOFA. We're about to put a NOFA out using the document recording fee funds for vets, and we think there could be an interesting overlay between serving veterans as well as veterans that have mental health needs. So we're looking at those strategies as well. We wanted to give you now a few case studies to really understand the work that we're doing and how we use these various funding sources together. So the first case study that we wanted to present is called Blue Springs Crossing in La Grande. It's family housing, 38 rental apartments that leveraged 9% federal tax credits with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, the GHAP funds, and then tax credit equity investment from a private investor. So the tax credit program here, an investment of $1.1 million of state funds through OHTC and GHAP,
yielded more than $6.5 million in private debt and equity for this project. So this just sort of gives you an example of how those state funds are helping to bring in those federal and private resources to affordable housing.
Just a reminder of what GHAP stands for.
General Housing Account Program. That's from the document recording fee.
Right.
Correct.
So you can see the, you know, this sort of very small slice of yellow here was able to bring in these considerable other resources, including that tax credit equity, which is that big blue bar from the private investment. Talking specifically about preservation, and then we have a case study to present as well. We have spoken a little bit with this committee this session about the importance of preservation, but just to make sure folks sort of keep this on top of mind, for every one new unit that's being produced of affordable housing nationally, at least two are at risk of loss, and that's either due to expiring rental assistance subsidies, expiring affordability restrictions, or frankly just the aging of those properties and their viability over the long term. Some of the property considerations, of course, energy efficiency. A lot of these properties, because they're aging, just do not have those energy efficiency upgrades in place. So they're really just hemorrhaging funding, paying for inefficient energy costs. A lot of these properties also have aging populations, a lot of senior properties, where folks need those repairs to be able to age in place, grab bars and other kinds of retrofits. Accessibility, a lot of these properties were built before the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so they just have not had the full accessibility improvements needed to make sure that they not only comply with federal law but remain viable for our populations today. And just overall habitability concerns. You know, a lot of these properties are owned by very savvy and well-run nonprofit organizations who are keeping them the basic habitability up, but they have not had major overhauls or rehabs through, you know, 30, 40, or even 50-year life of the property. So there's a lot of need to make sure that these properties stay viable. And frankly, a lot of these properties also receive that federal rental assistance. That's the rental assistance that we oversee through our contract with HUD. And if we don't renew those rental assistance contracts and make sure that to re-up them and make sure the properties remain viable, we're losing millions of dollars in federal resources from Oregon communities that are serving low-income people. So over the years, we have been lucky to receive preservation funding, lottery-backed bond funding for preservation, but we have not had a sustained comprehensive preservation initiative or a dedicated funding source for preservation. As I mentioned, the audit really called this out. We will be talking about this through our statewide housing plan process as well.
Question?
Yes.
Do you have a sense of how much out of the 76% that needs to go to the general housing account for preservation or new supply? How much of that has gone to preservation?
We'll have to look at that. We do have information about the lottery back bond funding for preservation, but the in terms of the document recording fee, I'm going to guess a handful of projects per year, and we can provide more detail to the committee on that breakdown. So we do have a case study to present to you. So Holiday Gardens was an acquisition rehab project that preserved three sites and more than 200 affordable apartments for seniors and persons with disabilities in three different communities. So it was a scattered site acquisition that brought together three communities in the same financing vehicle, Sandy, Talent, and Grants Pass. It preserved USDA Rural Development Rental Assistance contracts. It's, in fact, the largest USDA rural development project in the state. We work with USDA, a private lender, and a low-income housing tax credit equity investor to preserve and improve the development. And as you can see, this is elderly disabled housing and was really an innovative way that we were able to use our resources to do that preservation of three distinct sites in smaller communities. Now a case study on the LIFT program. Portland Road Apartments is right here in Salem. It's proximate to Hallman Elementary School, where 69% of the student body is Hispanic or Latino and 74% of the students are English learners. the majority of folks in this community are economically disadvantaged. So this LIFT development will include culturally appropriate services and amenities, including outdoor play facilities, a community garden, services such as self-sufficiency and nutrition classes, and childcare rooms. And DHS has actually indicated that they will dedicate a bilingual staff person to be on site at the project. The sponsor is building to scale, and the large size of the project is allowing a lower per unit development cost. So we talked a little bit earlier today about those development costs. If you look per unit, certainly if you're building a larger development, you're able to get an economy of scale and an efficiency at having a larger development. So here you can just see where we have the LIFT funds that are bringing in private grants, local home funds, long-term bonds, permanent debt, deferred development fee, and then that leveraged tax credit equity, which is that largest slice, that green stack here. And again, just showing how we were able to pair that 4% tax credit program with the LIFT so that you're getting more bang for your buck from those LIFT dollars by bringing in that private investment. And then we also wanted to give you an example of our work on manufactured home park preservation. When we talk about preserving affordable housing, we're also very focused on the need to preserve manufactured home parks and manufactured housing. This is a very important stock of housing for low-income Oregonians that has not, again, had a sort of a concerted strategic effort for preservation. But we have been pleased to be able to make these investments over the last several years. So the Oak Leaf Mobile Home Park is 33 spaces. This is a City of Portland project. We contributed just over $1 million, and we worked together with the City of Portland, and which used its federal CDBG funds, also brought in a private lender, and we preserved this 34-unit park. This is in the Cully neighborhood, which is a very quickly appreciating and gentrifying part of the city. There was a lot of concern about whether these folks would be able to stay in their homes as the rent on those pads was slated to increase. So we were pleased to be able to not only safeguard the long-term affordability, but as you can see, there's critical investments needed in this park to make sure that it's maintained and improved. So we're pleased to be able to do that. Thank you. So switching gears now to our single-family housing programs. These are state-funded programs to expand access to affordable home ownership. We talked a little bit earlier today about the Oregon Bond Loan Program. We provide below market rate loans, and we also assist homeowners in purchasing and retaining their homes through education, foreclosure counseling, down payment assistance, and other financial assistance services. The Homeownership Assistance Program, which is funded through the document recording fee. In 2016, we served more than 2,000 households through pre-purchase classes. And we provided down payment assistance to 280 families that are now permanently housed. And our residential loan program last year provided 410 mortgages. And again, I mentioned that we are really going like gangbusters in our single family activity this year, largely because of our below market product, which as interest rates have risen, has remained a very affordable option for first time home buyers.
Is this the one that you said was running out within a few months, the homeownership assistance program?
I don't believe so. Chair Kinnegar, I believe the one that we talked about that was running out was the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee. Money that the money that is in the governor's budget is at the current spin rate is going to be gone in about 6 months.
Also on the single family housing side, we did want to mention that we have a request for application out. This is a partnership we've had with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs using the document recording fee that's set aside for home ownership for veteran home repair. And this is to help veterans be able to stay in their homes, make those critical life safety repairs. And so we are now currently looking at applications from nonprofit organizations and housing counseling agencies that would administer those funds. We got great response, and we're excited about getting that program off the ground. So there are a number of proposed legislative changes to single-family housing that you all have looked at, including affordable homeownership grant programs, a task force on addressing racial disparities in home ownership. As I mentioned, that's certainly on our target list to be able to serve more minority households. And there's also some very interesting thinking about you know, serving homeowners in rural parts of the state, and also using the LIFT program for homeownership and being able to increase the income limits for LIFT so that we can appropriately use LIFT as a homeownership resource if we are so lucky to get additional bond authority for LIFT going forward. Any questions on those homeownership programs or legislative proposals? Okay, so switching gears now to the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, or OHSI. This is, again, the federal hardest hit funds that we administer that is assisting at-risk homeowners to avoid foreclosure through mortgage payment assistance, loan preservation assistance, and loan refinancing programs. Among other things, we help homeowners to be able to catch up on their mortgage payments. So again, critical resource to be able to help homeowners stay in their homes who are still really hard hit by the recession these many years later. And we also have been doing a lot of work with Oregon counties to be able to help these homeowners to pay their back taxes, because we're seeing that's another critical need, the property tax burdens that folks are facing, to be able to help them catch up on their taxes. So since 2010, we provided more than $200 million to keep Oregonians in their homes, and we've helped more than 11,000 struggling homeowners. This was a program that had been wound down, and then we received an additional $95 million from Treasury, I believe, in 2015. So we re-stood up that program last year and have been revamping it and kind of getting it back online to serve homeowners in the last several months. And then I believe the final program we wanted to mention was, again, the Oregon Volunteers Program. This is a program that is under our agency's management. Also, the court-appointed special advocates. There are a number of proposals at this stage in the legislative process to move these programs to other homes that better fit their mission. I will note that Oregon Volunteers promotes and supports volunteerism and civic engagement. It administers the AmeriCorps program for the state of Oregon. And the court-appointed special advocates program provides advocacy for children who have experienced neglect or abuse. And in 2014, 1,800 CASA volunteers serve more than 5,000 children. So we are eagerly working with our partners to work on the long-term plans for both of those programs and where they will be housed ongoing.
Okay. Yeah, we need to talk about this a little bit. Go ahead.
I have a question prior to that. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the helping Oregonians pay their back taxes, what does it cost to administer that plan? Because that seems strange that we would use tax dollars to help people pay their taxes.
We appreciate that comment, Representative. These are federal dollars. There's no state match to that program. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we'll have to look at what it costs to administer that and get back to you on that.
Those programs, so the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, that is the money that I mentioned earlier. We had to create a nonprofit to get that money. So this 220 plus the additional 95 that Director Salazar spoke of is money that you don't see in our budget. We created an administrative budget with the U.S. Department of Treasury when we agreed to take this money. Mm-hmm. And that is for the overall administration of all of the programs. And then so the program specifically that pays those back taxes, that has eligibility requirements and also a maximum benefit that those clients can receive. We'll have to follow up with you on what that maximum benefit is.
Thank you.
And it'll be interesting to see what the geographic distribution of that is.
Absolutely. I will mention that there's a website, Oregon Homeowner Help. It's linked from our website that has a ton of information about where all of the money has gone. We have to do extensive quarterly reporting with U.S. Treasury. And so there's a lot of really good information. We'll get you that. But it's a really good resource to understand where those dollars have gone.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, thank you. So you're talking about two of your programs, Volunteer Commission and also CASA. And CASA, you know, right now is, you know, there's some legislators here in the building. They're trying to find a new home for them right now on a temporary basis. I don't know. In case we ever were successful in doing something different, like what Representative Stark's doing for the ombudsman path, which I think truly makes sense. There's actually been some discussion about
keeping Kosovo with you, but they're just, you know, obviously needing some serious direction.
Yeah.
Right now, it's we have a bill that's in there for CJC, Criminal Justice Commission. So it's bouncing back and forth.
That's right. Representative and Chair, we certainly appreciate the comments. We've been trying to work with our liaisons in the governor's office to think about long-term strategies for both of these programs. You know, as we look at our agency's future and the work that we're doing with the statewide housing plan and our sort of strategic planning efforts, we're having to be very serious about our mission and keeping our mission focus. And unfortunately for our agency, we have had to subsidize the operations of those programs. And so being able to look at how we can be lean and mean and really use every dollar we have to support our core mission is where we're focused. But we certainly don't want to take anything away from the great work that those entities are doing. Okay. We're just having to be very clear about our focus.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Comments? I think one of the things that really struck me about this conversation is the 365,000 people that could lose, and I think that was people, not families, but could lose housing assistance. We've talked a lot about the 350,000 people that might get kicked off of the expanded Medicaid. This is a number even larger than that that could lose assistance. And just that really has struck me how little, in general, housing is among all of our conversations about the budget and where our primary concerns are. I know that we have a concern because we continually hear about it and people come and tell us the impact of not having housing on health and education systems and social services and economic development and jobs and what happens in Lincoln City or areas of the coast when restaurants are starting to put signs on the door. So I think we hear it in this committee, but it's just very evident to me that there's a lot of attention on areas like healthcare and others, which, you know, I don't begrudge. I think those are important too. But how little conversation there is about how little support we have for housing. So I think that's just my overall comment with all the different numbers here. And acting in an uncertain environment in terms of what federal programs may be cut and how we can really make sure that we do everything we can in this legislative session to shore up that foundation that people absolutely have to have in order to have good health or be able to apply for jobs, recover from mental health and addictions, et cetera. So that's kind of my overall impression. And the subcommittee that handles this agency's budget is not the Human Services sub. It's the Transportation and Economic Development, that's what it's called, who have not heard any of these stories at all. They don't. This is not who they are.
We have.
You're on it.
There's three of us on it.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's good. I'm really delighted that there's that overlap, because otherwise you don't, in that particular committee, you're not having any of the housing policy bills, so you're not hearing about that. So we're going to really count on you to be our ambassadors in that committee, and I, as a chair, will try to represent this committee in talking about the need. Some of it is supporting the agency's ability, certainly in the area of preservation. The House Bill 2002 is in a direct response to both what we hear in the community when we're losing housing that has had a significant public investment, mostly from the feds, and then we lose it, and it's not just the roof over people's house when all of a sudden 50 seniors have to leave and try to find housing in a low-vacancy area, but it's the community that they've built as well. So in order for that to happen, it's not just the preservation dollars, but there needs to be some infrastructure to help us keep a database on what are those units that are coming up. And that is where the audit actually dinged the agency the most. And so this is in part in direct response to that, and that's something that I very heavily support. The agency, right at a time where the recession was hitting hard and the housing crisis was hitting particularly hard, lost a lot of positions. And I understand the kind of lean and mean, and maybe you have to lose certain positions at a certain point to be very intentional about where you're going to build back. But I think that clearly we need an infrastructure to be able to
direct the policy of where the resources are most needed. A lot of the bills that we have before us actually work with community agencies. They're not building up the capacity of OHCS. Some do, but some are also trying to put grant dollars in the hands of community action agencies and others. So there's a real public-private partnership in where a lot of these dollars get directed. But that can't be in the absence of a policy-making body that's really keeping the data fresh about where the needs are greatest. So that was kind of my overall comment. Anyone else wants to say anything? Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that three people on this committee are on that sub. That's really, really important. And hopefully I will be presenting on behalf of our committee back to you at some point.
I just want to thank you and thank the committee for the opportunity to come back and address you. And for those members that are also on our Ways and Means Subcommittee, thank you for sitting through this presentation again.
Yeah.
But we really appreciate the opportunity to answer your questions, and we'd be glad to do that offline at any time.
And I note that there's about 12 more pages past the questions part here with more appendices on the policy option package and other kinds of things. So more homework for you, or time on the floor. If you're looking for something to do while we're on the floor. Thank you so much for this. I'm going to close the informational hearing and adjourn. Thank you so much for this. I'm going to close the informational hearing and adjourn. Thank you.